Hi, folks. Before we get started with today's episode, we just wanted to let you know that we now have a new and easier way of looking at all of the works or the objects that we talk about in our episodes. We now have a carousel where you can easily swipe through all of the images that we discuss. You can find this either in our show notes or on our website. Hopefully this makes things a little bit easier. And as always, you can find further information and further reading on our website as well.
Hello and welcome to Drawing Blood, our podcast about the history of science and medicine, art and visual culture, and the macabre. I'm Emma Merkling.
And I'm Christy Slobogan.
And we have a super exciting episode today. We're going to be talking about Fin de Siècle Paris, printmaking and consumerism, morphine addiction, especially female addiction, and all things decadence, degeneration, and disease. So content warnings for this episode include discussion of addiction and, more than that, harmful or stigmatizing portrayals of addiction.
So I'm like coursing with excitement. First of all, because of this episode, I'm really excited about this episode. Second of all, because I just bought Kim Petras tickets and I'm so fucking excited.
Feeling excluded.
I know. Well, I bought two tickets. My fiance doesn't have to come. He can suck it up. I think you would have more fun. Anyway, speaking of women, I'm very excited for this episode. And for those listeners who have listened to a lot of our episodes, they know that Emma and I kind of alternate on who brings in the object that we start with that then kind of snowballs into whatever we end up talking about on the episode. So it's my turn, and I've brought in an 1897 print called Morphinomaniac by Eugène Grasset. You're going to make fun of my French accent the entire episode.
I'm not, because I had a stun talking to with myself ahead of this show where I was like, we're not going to try to say the French names in French, because I feel like it's one of those things where if you can do it and you can do it well, it's one thing. If you even slightly butcher it, it's another thing. And both ways are kind of cringy. So Grasset.
Grasset. Absolutely. Oh, that makes Slay. Me feel so much better. I'm so pleased. Anyway, brought in this print called Morphinomaniac, which we'll have Emma describe in just a minute. But I've been obsessed with this piece of art since 2015. This was maybe my... pun maybe intended, gateway drug to art and medicine. I wrote about morphine and women in Fin de Siècle Paris for like my final paper for my art and medicine class. And so this image is what like catapulted the whole thing. And I found out about it because I used to, thinking that it would really, you know, help my career as an art historian, I used to have art news as my homepage.
Oh my God.
I know.
That's the most Capricorn shits I've ever heard.
I know. And so
that's more Capricorn than you texting with periods at the end of every sentence.
Is it? I don't know. No, but truly, for several years, I had art news as my homepage. And this was one of the, they had like a little article about, I don't know, this print. And I just thought it was so cool. So that's what I am presenting to you today. And do you want to tell our viewers about it? As always, these will be linked. The images will be linked in show notes. You'll be able to look at them on our website, all of that.
I'm really excited because we're finally, I mean, the last episode notwithstanding, like this, the Fin de Siècle, this is my period. This is my genre. This is my, like, I'm at home, you know? And I'm kind of surprised we've done so few. I mean, I've been reining myself in, but like that we've done so few 19th century episodes. I mean, but also because the podcast, you know, is like meant to be for us to explore stuff we don't usually get to. But yeah, I'm stoked. I've never looked at the morphine prints, but a lot of these themes I've like taught about a lot. So excited. Okay.
Exciting.
Okay. Oh my God, this is such a cool print. So it's a really like bright and colorful print. It's sort of, to me, it's a very like late 19th century France, almost tending towards Art Nouveau kind of print, you have these really bold, flat, not entirely flat, but like pretty flat colors, almost like a cartoon, you know? So there's the figure has this like heavy outline to her, and it's a female figure. She's wearing a white dress and she's sort of hunching forward. And I think the first thing you notice is her facial expression, which is, I wonder if we're going to talk about Charcot and the photographs of hysterics at the, what is it?
Salpêtrière, yeah.
But, you know, her mouth is clenched. It almost looks physiognomic, you know? She has this expression, her brow is furrowed, her eyes are sort of wide and staring, but also she has these sort of lowered lids. So it's not quite fear, even though she has these like gritted teeth and this furrowed brow. And, you know, you can see the lines on her cheeks where she's like, and her neck is really tense. Her shoulders are up, but her gaze is soft. And that combined with like the disheveled hair is interesting because it sort of suspends this between, I don't know, like pain and pleasure almost. I don't know if that's maybe going to.
I literally have pain and pleasure written down in my notes.
Oh my God.
Not totally convinced about the pleasure, but we'll talk more about it and definitely talk more about hysteria as well.
Yes. I don't mean pleasure as in that she's necessarily experiencing pleasure, more that pleasure is part of the visual vocabulary of the print. So
absolutely.
Perhaps she's like absolutely. a woman of pleasure. You know, I don't know her class or social status, but she has this like disheveled hair. She's in an interior, clearly. She's sitting on this sort of green chair.
Yeah.
But I haven't mentioned the most striking part of the image yet, which is that she's injecting herself with what appears to be a hypodermic syringe, which I'm a level with you. I did not know was a thing yet by... Oh, wait. What did you say this was 1897. Makes sense, but I'd never thought about it. And on the table is a little vial, which I presume has the substance she's injecting into herself in it. And it's sort of on her thigh. So she's like pulled up her dress. She wears a wedding band, which is interesting.
Yeah. I don't know what to do with that, honestly. Yeah. I don't know what to do with that, but you have to mention it.
I think I have some ideas actually, but maybe I'll save them. And then I guess final thoughts is just that the contents of the bottle is green, which is really interesting to me because I don't know much about, I mean, I can imagine what she's injecting into herself is morphine, given that I know the theme of this episode. But for me, when I think green and I think Paris at the Fin de Siècle, I'm thinking absinthe. So it's sort of evoking these other drugs and illicit, but it evokes these like mind-altering or addictive substances like alcohol, like drugs. I don't know if it's prescription or illegal drugs, but yeah, it's sort of a very aestheticized but quite disturbing print. And it's also, which I'm sure we'll get into, but also because of the time period, it's also a bit giving the language of advertising to me.
I think you've touched on a lot of the things that we want to get to today, we being me. That's excellent. It's a really fascinating print. I kind of want to dig a little bit deeper onto a couple of the things that you said. First of all, so this print, as I said, 1897, called Morphinomaniac. As you can probably imagine from that title, it means morphine maniac, or like someone who has a mania for morphine. Another title for this is literally Morphinomania. So like the title, instead of focusing on her, focuses on like the disease or the, well, we can talk about whether it was a disease or not in that period, but on what she's representing, right? It's by Eugène Grasset, who was a Swiss artist working in Paris from 1871 onwards. And it's from a suite of 32 prints published by Ambroise Vollard. And he was known for getting these Parisian artists to explore printmaking, right? So like Picasso did a Vollard suite. A lot of these artists working in Paris were approached by him to do these print suites. So meaning that there were multiples, meaning that it was mostly for private collectors and print collectors, right? So this wouldn't have necessarily been up on a wall in a gallery or in a museum.
Okay, because
right?
That's what I had a question about that. Like, what was the purpose or context of this print?
And so in this print suite, there were a lot of different topics, but this one kind of sticks out, honestly. And he did other print suites. One that he did was called 10 Decorative Prints, which also we'll talk about this more with Grasse, but it focused on women, again, like a single woman, like a quote unquote cover girl, which, you know, relates to advertising again. And in the 10 decorative prints series that Grasse did, he would have women representing different emotions like anxiety or inquietude.
I think this thing of representing emotion is really interesting because, you know, the thing about those Charcot prints of hysterics or, you know, female inmates at Salpêtrière is precisely that they're depicting these extremely over the top, we'll link to some photos, these extremely over the top women in states of high emotion.
Absolutely. So inquietude, you'll see some people have brought up the parallels between the woman that Grasse portrays in Inquietude, also 1897, and the Morphinomaniac. Yeah, so that's kind of the context in which this was published. You know, he's making other print suites, but this does kind of stand out in his oeuvre. But I'll show you another one that I think is similar, but a little bit later. Definitely the color is the most striking part about the composition here to me, in particular the way that the yellow of the background almost feels to degenerate into this like sickly splotchy situation at the bottom left. Yes. It's almost like it dissolves,
or that there's this darkness encroaching from the bottom. Oh. Is more how I read it.
Yeah, it definitely could be that as well. And it really puts me in mind of the yellow wallpaper. I mean, I can't see a yellow wall and not think about the yellow wallpaper, which is by Charlotte Perkins Gilman. And it's about a woman going mad, essentially. I mean, that is the most basic description of it. And it's from 1892. And so that's kind of a context in which this domestic space of this woman shooting up morphine is positioned within.
But I was thinking more like the context that I'm more familiar with, which is the British decadence and the artists of the 1890s and like Aubrey Beardsley and what the color yellow signified to them, which was, you know, Absolutely. They had this periodical called The Yellow Book, which was sort of at the avant-garde. I'm sure we'll talk about decadence in a little bit, but also that this color yellow for them was linked to French degeneracy, and especially the fact that French pornography or like illicit novels at this time often had the color yellow on them. For instance, in Oscar Wilde's Picture of Dorian Gray, he's reading a yellow book that is probably Haussmann's A Rebours or Against Nature. And I think Wilde was also caught with a yellow book when he was arrested for like acts of indecency, i.e. homosexuality, which is also in the 1890s. So yellow at this time definitely connotes like deviancy, degeneracy, but also like an artistic avant-garde.
Yes. And the act happening here of a woman taking morphine, and a woman presumably addicted to morphine, that was something associated in particular with women, associated with artists, associated with the bohemian crowd. So it definitely fits in with what you're saying. And yeah, the yellow wallpaper is just tying it, like that connects it more directly to female degeneracy, that reference. But yeah, so that yellow and that texturing is really important and interesting, I think. And then staying on that theme of the color, I also think her skin color is really important, and we'll talk about skin a little bit later, but her skin, especially because it's up against this white, this like pure white dress that she's got, it's very clear that her skin color has a greenish tinge. You know, it's somewhere in between the green of the chair and the white of her dress. And Hannah Halliwell, who I wish her book was out. It's coming out January 2024, but listen to how perfect this would be for the episode. Her book is called Art, Medicine, and Femininity, Visualizing the Morphine Addict in Paris, 1870 to 1914.
Well, we could have used that.
No, we could, but I was too impatient. I did talk to Hannah and she's been super helpful with this episode, but I was too impatient. So everybody go pre-order that book. It's McGill Queens University Press. Going to be out January 2024. It's going to be amazing and I can't wait to read it. She's got a couple of articles out that we'll reference as well. But anyway, Hannah Halliwell talks about how this was definitely a trope of visualizing the morphine addict, where their skin had this corpse-like color, halfway between green and white. Also, this color combination of this really acidic, sickly yellow and green, these were colors that were associated with another threat to I guess, bourgeois upstanding life, which was the venereal peril of syphilis, was associated with these two like sickly colors. And so then, you know, that relates to this theme of degeneration that you were talking about, of bohemians, quote unquote, alternate lifestyles, right, in this period, and kind of the medical or like physical threats that were seen to inhabit that lifestyle.
Well, maybe it's worth for, I'm sure you know about like decadence and degeneration, but maybe it's worth for our listeners just sort of saying it, like outlining it explicitly, just because I think it's such an important context going on here.
And I will say, like, there was only one book chapter that I could find that related specifically to this print. And it's literally in a book called Decadence, Degeneration, and the End. And so obviously, and it's yellow.
I cited that book a lot in my PhD.
No way. Yeah
look, there's a chapter on heat death.
And see, you didn't read all the chapters, because otherwise you would have seen this print.
No comment. I always read books cover to cover.
Always, always. That's the only way to read.
Okay. So I guess maybe like an entry point for me that I thought of when I first saw this print that brings a lot of these themes together and gets us to sort of these ideas about degeneracy, degeneration, decadence is Henri de Toulouse-Lautrec.
Yes.
And because you already mentioned sort of those sickly green colors, those yellow colors, these suggestions of decay, he is always who I think about. And he also made these, you know, posters for advertising as well, which I believe Grasset did as well.
Yes, yes, we'll talk about that.
And Toulouse-Lautrec is interesting because both in his biography as the most famous sufferer of what is now commonly known as Toulouse-Lautrec syndrome, and as a frequenter of the Paris underworld, who visited a lot of sex workers who ended up dying of syphilis, I believe, and or alcoholism. Yep. You know, he's one of these figures that really encapsulates the sort of late 19th century, fin de siècle French, kind of between a flâneur and like consumer, right? Of women, of substances, yes, of goods, but also because, you know, there's this really, oh God, I'm going to butcher this because it's completely from memory, but a fellow painter, I wonder if it was Vuillard, had a quote where he basically said that, you know, Lautrec visited these women because he, as a freak, and I quote, he felt at home with them. And so there's also these interlinked ideas of disability, disease, addiction, sort of sex. The quote unquote sex work, the seedy underbelly of Paris.
Absolutely. A really, really good connection to like a better known artist that folks might be able to use as a grounding point.
Yeah.
Right. For understanding this image.
And I guess this context of Paris in this point in general and the ideas about degeneration that associated with it are also part of this context, right? So I think it's the Third Empire, right? 1870 onwards. And Paris is once again experimenting with democracy. And you have this rapid shift in its urban program and this like rapid modernization of Paris, you know, the Haussmannization of it, the building of these big boulevards. Soon the metro will be there, that explosion of cafes, like there's like 30 or 40,000 in Paris at this point. Also a fun fact I recently discovered was the reason a lot of people turned to absinthe and these sort of more intense liquors was because the wine crop was attacked by a parasite in like the 1880s and it like wiped out a year or more's worth of wine.
That's amazing. Yeah, I love that.
So people turned to these other substances, and part of the sort of program of this new democracy, I guess, was the sometimes reluctant, but sort of liberalization of a lot of things. So a lot of brothels were state sanctioned and legal. A lot of sex work was legalized. And, the consumption of alcohol was legal. The consumption of, I think absinthe is like 70 proof or something, like really intense. Yeah. Alcohol was legal. And that combined with this sort of, you know, classes being brought into dangerous contact with each other for the first time in places like the theater or the street, the boulevard, you know, you have all these fears emerging around this idea that, you know, there's contamination in the air. And also we have, of course, germ theory, right? And like Louis Pasteur. And, you know, this idea, I think it's more intense in Britain than France, but definitely also going on in France, that there is the sort of moral decay that is somehow linked to physical decay and has something to do with this range of things like liberated women. I mean, scare quotes a bit, but, you know, let's say women working for money, which is either through sex work or the new woman, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. Women is unsupervised consumers, because you also have the first department stores at this point, and women could go to them unchaperoned. And sorry, that was more of a tangent than I meant.
No, so that's really, really good context. And I think we can read a lot of that into this print. So I kind of want to take what you said about, you know, women as consumers and also this idea of sex and how those might be related, but like women as consuming and consumable, as these both subjects and objects that can be both consumed and consuming.
Yeah.
And some of the arguments for this piece also relate to what you said earlier about that mixture of pain and pleasure, right? Which if you think about it, or not even think about it that hard, like that is inherently erotic as well, those that combination of words. And you've got this woman in this print tensing up so hard, and you've got this tension of muscles, you've got this facial expression of perhaps pain and pleasure mixed, and then you've got, it's almost like every part of her is vibrating, from her hair to her arms, where she's sitting, her thighs. But then you've got this absolute control in this finger that is pressing down on this hypodermic syringe. Yeah. And in this period, the rush of the morphine high was equated to the rush of an orgasm. So that's very much what Grasset is playing on. Like, it's this
woman
who—
But that makes so much sense, looking at the
print. Absolutely. It's what you said, like this equation of all these things that happened in the seedy underbelly of Paris being thrown together into this one print. And not only is it this consumption of this drug, but also can be read as like an autoeroticism, an auto consumption. Like, she is consuming herself. She is giving herself pleasure through this needle. And in this period that you're talking about of degeneration, the context that you were just describing, masturbation, that auto consumption, that autoeroticism, like morphine use, was thought of as an epidemic ill, especially as applied to women. Like, it was thought, oh my God, these women are totally degenerate. They're not only are they taking drugs and consuming themselves and their bodies that way. I mean, look at, she does look like kind of on the more brittle side. Her body feels like aged beyond what it should be, especially with this like luscious hair.
Definitely.
But you've also got like, oh, these women are also pleasuring themselves and finding pleasure in their own ways, whether that be through drugs or through sex or through masturbation. That all is cinched up as well, I think, not only in the tension of that finger pressing down on the needle, but also the way that she is clutching herself. Like, I think we mentioned the Bernini hand maybe in the last episode.
Last ep.
But it's very much that, like, the way that Grasset has put these slight shadows under her left hand, the one with the wedding ring on it, the way that it is clutching her thigh to fill her thigh with blood, to get the morphine to rush through her body, to get that orgasmic feeling faster, is also very sexual and very tactile and pliable. This idea of like the auto-consuming, auto-erotic, consumable woman, but also dangerously consumable, right? It's like, oh, consuming her sexually might kill you. kind of where it's at.
I have like a billion thoughts branching off of this. But where I want to start is, maybe, you know, you said pain and pleasure are sort of inherently erotic. That's a phenomenon of this point in time. And it has to do with these ideas about, you know, what had happened to the social order in sort of cultural right understandings of, you know, like moral panic. And for me, this all sort of coalesces around kind of this image of the femme fatale, you know, who can be this hypersexualized woman who is at once like a threat and dangerously seductive, which, you know, we can either read the morphine as that or the woman herself. I think there's a slippage there. But more than that, it's giving vampire. Do you know about the
monk? Monk vampire. Monk's vampire print from a similar, I think maybe the same year.
Yes, here it is. He didn't actually call it his vampire, but it was immediately basically in the periodical press called that. And you have this like woman with this red hair hunching over this man's neck. But there's a whole series of books, especially leading up to this point, that deal with the sort of the trope of the female vampire. And I guess maybe to make it explicit, the reason I think this came into both of our minds is she is the puncturing, right? The like the needle going into the skin, that, I mean, she's not drawing blood. Ha ha. Oh my God. We said the name of the the movie in the movie.
That's us. We're drawing blood.
She, you know, she's not drawing blood, but there's slippage there between, you know, the puncturing of the smooth skin and the gender deviancy that that suggests, right? Women don't penetrate. That there's a sort of moral deviancy being mapped onto a sexual deviancy here, as well as that sort of both autoerotic but also sapphic idea of woman in sensuous contact with herself, pleasuring herself. And I'm thinking of the Sheridan Le Fanu book Carmilla. I don't know if you know it from 1872. There's a great Sam Hurst, I think it's a blog post or an essay about this, but it's this very sapphic sort of horror story about this female vampire. And what's really interesting is at the end, she gets punished and there's like this return to heterosexual norms. So it's quite clear that this sort of sapphic figure of the female vampire who is a deviant is to be punished and is like outside the norms of, you know, what is allowed. But I think there's also something about consumption and consumerism in that, you know, the female vampire who is like sucking the blood. What is also deviant is the taking, you know, the act of taking and the act of consumption. And we already mapped that. I mean, you know, because you mentioned, or we've discussed sort of working class women in the guise of sex workers at this point. I don't know what the class of the woman in the image is. I sort of wonder if the wedding ring suggests she's not necessarily a sex worker. And this is more like a middle class thing. And that links it back again to the sort of this shopping and consumption phenomenon in Paris in general at this point.
Yeah. And I reread my undergraduate essay on this, right? And I have this whole argument about how this woman is a prostitute and how she fits within the history of prostitution and like prostitution laws in Paris in this period. And I'm reading it and I'm like, oh, 21-year-old Christy, I don't think you're right, actually. I mean, I got a good grade on it, but I don't think I was right. So I'm with you on that. And I think the wedding ring is part of that. But no, I'm so glad that you brought up Monk's vampire, quote unquote vampire image, because there's, as we said, like there's so much of the energy in this print is focused on the puncturing of the skin or the almost puncturing of the skin. Like if you look really closely, it's not quite there yet. The skin hasn't broken. There's no drop of blood to show that she's been punctured or that her skin barrier has been broken. And that idea of like the big text on this is The Skin Ego by Didier Anzia. And so like this is this idea that women with their perfect smooth skin, and Linda Need writes about this too in the female nude.
I was going to say, you don't even need to go there. Like it's all in the history of the female nude in the 19th century.
Absolutely. So it's like the female nude or female body is safe to view with this barrier of the skin, with unbroken skin. So women should be this like perfect unbroken entity, right? I find it really interesting in the context of this piece that like you've got that kind of modeling, like as you said, like that creeping darkness coming up from the bottom, or as I said, like that yellow degenerating into the darkness at the bottom, that show that Grasset can use lithography to model things, like to make things look kind of bruised and broken. And it's really interesting that he chose not to use lithography in that way for her skin, because that was in this period, one of the reasons that morphinomaniacs were so terrifying, which is, you know, we can apply this to a lot of things like, you know, being homosexual in this period or like, you know, and any other things that are quote unquote degenerate, is that they were hard to diagnose by people in the bourgeoisie, right, who saw these things as threatening. And so the only way to diagnose a morphine addict in this period was either they had the bruises and the scars on their arms and legs, right, or they were in the exact moment of injecting themselves with morphine, which is what Grasset is doing here, right? He's like, there's no question that this woman is a morphinomaniac because we've caught her in the act. Or the other way to diagnose them is in withdrawal. So it's like in the absence of morphine, right? So there was this fear of these women among them, like if you didn't catch them in the act, then how are you going to know that they were a morphine addict? And one of the really interesting things is that like I write a lot about how about the shortcomings of medical photography, like in this period and later, right? And so one of the things is that the photography of this period, they would try to create diagnostic images of morphine addicts by showing the scars and the marks and the bruises on the skin, right? But it did not come through well in photographs. So a lot of artists had to be the ones who would make these diagnostic images. So in a way, like, there are so few images of people actually injecting themselves with morphine. So in a way, Grasset's image is filling in this whole genre of medical image that does not exist otherwise. That's all in Hannah Halliwell's article as well about wax, like, because wax would be used to show the skin that photography couldn't. You know what I mean?
And but what's also interesting about that, and also sidebar, I want more info on morphine mania, like,
we'll get
but I just want to say, in general, at this point, I don't know if you know this, but like, Paris was, that idea of wax also links to not just degeneracy, which I think we'll get back to, but like the salacious character and like tabloid press of a lot of this period. I'm also thinking of like painters like Walter Sickert, who depicted in Britain, you know, like women from sort of London's underworld. He was alleged to be Jack the Ripper at one point, you know.
Yes.
but Paris had these like wax work, almost like a cross between Madame Tussauds and like the Daily Mail, like waxwork depictions of like salacious crime scenes and like other things that had happened around Paris. So this like kind of creeping, dark, bruising, but also like wax beautifying, yeah. Well, not even beautifying, just like creation into an aesthetic object, I think, like, also yes. Is very of its moment.
No, definitely. So you've got this idea of skin and surface, right? And this was something that we actually talked about a lot in the Andy Warhol episode last season, in the way that it related to Warhol's role in the advertising world and in consumerism. Totally different period, different country. But like, I think this idea of skin and surface and the flat plane of a print once again makes us think of advertising. And we talked about like this woman being an auto consumer, like someone who's consuming herself through this drug and through sexualized body.
And like, you know, I don't think it's a stretch to say that like this period, that period of like hyper consumption and the expansion of consumer goods and a consumer goods market also marketed to women very much mirrors the like 1950s and 1960s. And, you know, today as well, you know, that there are, I don't think it's a coincidence that those are the two moments that in which we're talking about this stuff.
No, absolutely not. And Grasset himself was known for his advertising images that had quote unquote, you know, cover girls. So like beautiful bourgeois commercial aesthetics. So this is kind of like the flip side of that cover girl, right? It's like cover girl gone wrong in Morphinomaniac. But usually these cover girls were, as I said earlier, desirable females who were consuming, both consuming and consumerable. Nope.
Leave that in.
Both consuming and consumable. Consuming and consumable. But he, every once in a while, I've got these two examples of Morphinomaniac and another one, he would take this femininity and make it dark. Hold on.
And actually, while you're pulling that up, I didn't get to this when I was describing the image, but it reminds me a lot of some of the paintings of witches and diabolism that's taking place in the 1890s in general. Like, do you know the famous like Batwoman painting?
Yes, I do.
What's his name?
I do.
And then also... One sec, I just want to show you, sorry.
Is this going to be the image, I think? I knew it's exactly the image I thought it was going to be. Yes.
By Louis Ricardo Falero. It's Faust's Vision. And you have these women with like, it's the disheveled black hair and also the open, the mouth, the face that's in a state of like aggravation.
Yes, yes, absolutely. And like these tense kind of like writhing bodies with, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think that's a really good reference.
Oh my God, okay, I know this one. The Acid Thriller. Yes. Sorry, I just opened the link.
So I just sent Emma the other example that I think of as like the dark side of femininity that we see in Morphinomaniac is also present in Grasset's print, The Acid Thrower. You can see that she's also got this greenish skin aligning her to this attic kind of trope. But really what it is it's another type of feminized mania that we see in Morphinomaniac. It's like the addiction is feminized, but then you've got this equation of hysteria or of jealousy to hysteria to morphine addiction within these two Grasset prints, right? Like you've got this like feminized, intense, obsessive violence. And that really is kind of like the dark side of Grasset's cover girls.
I just want to say visually, I hope we get to Japonisme in this episode, because I think this print and the last one are so clearly influenced by Japanese woodblock printing, which was experiencing a resurgence in like Europe from the 1860s onwards, and also has a lot to do with consumer culture if you think of like Hokusai's dark outline, the flat planes of color, exactly. The color yellow, which does already have racialized overtones.
Of course.
At this point. Yeah. I mean, it's associated with like racialized understandings of Asian people, as well as we said, degeneration, dangerous effeminacy, decay, all these Orientalist tropes that, you know, absolutely. Japanese is an interesting one because it sort of enters the culture in both negative and positive ways. Like it becomes this source of like inspiration for a lot of Western artists, and they speak a lot and write a lot about this skill, you know, of the Japanese artists who they are sort of lovingly drawing close to. And then at the same time, there's this like vilification and fear of the encroachment of the other, the foreign, the effeminacy, the languorousness. And actually, it makes me think a bit of like opium dens as well, which also become a thing in the 19th century with a wave of Chinese immigration. Although I think that's like male working class coded. You know, they're dangerous because you have these like men languishing around like women, basically.
Yes. Yeah. And well, when we dive a little bit more into the history of morphine, we'll talk about opium dens. But yeah, so this Japanese was also very much the language of advertising as well, right? Like this flat woodblock printing. And so I wanted to send you and have you, where is it? Here it is.
I'm going to use that musical interlude to tell our listeners, almost said viewers, that Christy recently disclosed to me that she had a rival a cappella group in college. That's the end of it.
Okay. You had to be there, but it's true. We had competitions. There, we were rivals with people. And, you know, I think I was about to say it's the nerdiest thing I've ever done. And then I remembered I have a PhD. So maybe it's the geekiest thing I've ever done. I don't know. Right. So this is another contemporaneous advertising image. And it's got that figure of the quote-unquote cover girl that was really common in this period, right? And that we've been saying that Gresset also used. So tell me what's going on here and what do you think this, the thing that they're advertising is?
Surely a wine because it says vin at the top.
But, yes.
Oh my God, and popular French tonic wine at the bottom. But it's it's a woman in yellow who's sort of caught mid, you know, she's dancing, but sort of like the women dance at the Moulin Rouge, sort of flinging her skirts up and leaping. And in her hand, she's pouring a bottle of wine into a glass. And in the background, there's another figure who's holding up a wine glass as well.
Right. So there are a couple of parallels between like this advertising image and the print that was not for advertising, that was bought by private collectors, right? But I found this one interesting because this is actually a wine with cocaine in it. So
it's my God. Literally, like, no one, people in the 19th century, cocaine, morphine, opium, absinthe.
Yeah. So you can see how, like, this language of addiction is also tied up with this language of advertising and this cover girl, drugged up woman, basically. But it can either be fun and flirty here or dangerous and barrier breaking in the morphinomaniac print, right? But yeah, everyone, cocaine and wine, morphine and needles, all of it. And in 1906, this novelist, Victorien de Saussay, wrote, "In Paris alone, there are more than 300,000 scum who shoot up morphine, drink ether, swallow hashish, smoke opium." Like, that's everything. Based. That's, yeah.
Wait, Chrissy. Okay, now I really need to know more. I want it, like, who's consuming, I feel like I need to, like, who's consuming morphine? What is the epidemic? Like, what's the background to all of this?
Yeah. So obviously lots of drugs flying around, lots of mind-altering substances. It's very much part of the like fin de siècle degeneration culture. So very like quick history of morphine, right? But so basically morphine is a psychotropic drug, which means that it affects your mental state, right? And morphine is like one of the oldest psychotropic drugs from literally like 3600 BCE is when poppies started to be cultivated, right? So you think of that scene from The Wizard of Oz where they all fall asleep in the poppies.
Haven't seen it.
What?
Yep.
All right. Well, that's truly,
it's the perfect handshake between theater kid and complete lack of theater kid.
Luckily, we have other shared interests. But
death.
But anyway, so you know, poppy started to be cultivated ages and ages and ages ago. And in the 19th century, opium and its products could be consumed as pills, as lozenges, powders, plasters, even as enemas.
Oh my God.
Which is thrilling. And so like the liquid version is laudanum. So accidental overdoses were super common, especially in children, because children would be given laudanum.
Sorry, I don't know if you said this out loud yet, but they're prescribed, right? These are like medical concoctions.
Definitely medical concoctions. I think a lot of it was like what we would call over the counter now, though.
Sure.
I mean, you could get wine with cocaine in it. So, you know, not super regulated, but I'll get to regulation in a bit. But, you know, these risks of overdose were kind of thought of as minor in comparison to the pain or the diseases that you were facing. Like laudanum or other forms of taking an opiate could be used if you have cancer, right? Like that's what you've got. An opiate is your only recourse, which, I mean, some parallels to today as well, you know. But even though opium is this very old plant and drug that people have been using for literally thousands of years, morphine is a fully modern concoction, like very 19th century concoction, right? It's very much grounded in the 19th century. In 1804, a German pharmacist isolated the chemical component of morphine, which is an alkaloid, and he called it morphium after Morpheus, the god of dreams.
I was going to ask if it's like Morpheus related. Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Which also, by the way, in the only painting I can think of Morpheus, which is, I think, also by a French painter, but 18th century, he is sort of like languishing backwards in this very almost feminized open body pose.
Yeah,
but that's sort of a sidebar.
No, I like that connection. That's cool. I'm into it. So 1804, the chemical component was isolated. 1821, it was popularized as a medicine. So often as a syrup or as a quote unquote calming drop. That was by a French physiologist. And then in 1830 to 1860, what was popular was the endermic method, which is where you would literally blister your skin and then place the morphine directly on it so that it would absorb into your skin.
What do you mean blister your skin?
Burn it and then open the blister.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah. So it goes straight through the skin.
How?
But they didn't have needles then, right? So that was the way to get it through the skin pre-needles. So the big moment was 1859, which is when the hypodermic syringe was invented. That was like the moment, right? 1859, big moment, hypodermic syringe invented. But then it became an even more explosive invention with the Franco-Prussian War of 1870. At that moment is when they're like, oh, this is how we're going to use this syringe that was invented 10 years ago. Huge increase of morphine use from the 1870s to the 1890s. So just to give you a little bit of context for this, to realize how much of an uptick it was in morphine use, in the Central Parisian pharmacy, for example, in 1855, they used about a quarter kilo of morphine. In 1875, it was 10 kilos of morphine. And then in the 1890s, it was an average of 750 kilos of morphine going through this pharmacy. So like, yeah. So the uptick is just like exponential, right?
Yeah. It makes sense because if it's anything like current opiates, it's like intensely addictive.
Oh, and prescriptions could be refilled indefinitely in those pharmacies.
Oh, nice. Like
they weren't regulated.
Yeah, why would you need regulation?
But in 1891, this was like a very common conception. It was like morphine is the, quote, the most useful innovation of the 19th century.
Okay.
Not sure we would say that.
Sorry, maybe this is off topic, but like, was there some dissent? Like, surely some people, I mean, surely the effects of addiction were quite visible.
Yes. But in terms of like the history of addiction, even though it was known, like there was one doctor who in 1884 was like, yeah, it's probably 8 out of 10 people who are addicted to morphine were prescribed it by their doctors. Once again, sounds a lot like the opioid epidemic now.
Yeah.
But even if that addiction was iatrogenic, which is the idea that your addiction starts with a physician's prescription, iatrogenic addiction, which is what Grasset's woman likely was that she had been prescribed this morphine. But even if your addiction started with a legitimate reason to take this drug, that didn't garner any sympathy in this period. Very much an addict was an addict, regardless, which, you know, that idea still persists as well. But and it wasn't a crime, but it was still seen as like an element of the degeneration of the society. That was very much part of it.
So wait, why did you say that it was likely that Grasset's subject began using morphine this way? Why? Just because of the class stuff we've said, or like the, you know, she's married?
Well, partially because of the wedding ring, partially just in terms of like likelihood. And this idea of like morphine injection, as prescribed by a male doctor was very much associated with young women. Like it was either you were a young, pretty woman who was bored or like...
Do you know what it reminds me of a bit? Also because we've talked about Warhol and now this is in my mind, like the housewives getting prescribed meth basically, or like methamphetamines in the 1940s, 50s, 60s, which is also like linked to this like very gendered part of what happens with gender and capitalistic consumption, you know, yeah, in modernity.
Absolutely. And it was the way that people ingested morphine was also very gendered. Like women were associated with injecting morphine. Men were associated with smoking it, right? Only men smoked and men drank alcohol. And that was also racialized as well. I mean, you talked about opium dens, but like this cleaner, quote unquote, heaviest quotes, like cleaner hypodermic syringe opium was contrasted against the quote unquote oriental opium, which was seen as much worse, which they could see that it had ravaged China. And that was very much like a stereotype. This was seen as like not quite that, even though obviously just as bad. But, and that came from like, there was this really famous book from 1821 called Confessions of an Opium Eater. And we're like, oh, yeah, but it's not eating opium if you're injecting it into your thigh. And so like, therefore.
Oh, a different beast, but it does seem from this print, and I don't know if you're going to show me more prints or drawings sort of morphomania, but it does seem that it's still very much like perceived as a threat. And I wonder if part of that does, I mean, you know, I've been gesturing towards this a lot, but there is a really important linked set of ideas here around like gendering, racialization, orientalization, also class. And maybe it's worth just mentioning like Max Nordau at this point, who in the early 1890s published this book, Degeneration, where, and I think this is interesting also for the themes of our podcast, like he looks to artists who and writers who he sees as degenerate, and he sees them as this sort of like lazy, like upper class, a danger to society. And, you know, think of the rise of dandies. If you think of Oscar Wilde and Dorian Gray, or, you know, any number of these figures who are famous at the end of the century for firstly deliberately resisting and quite visibly resisting norms of sexuality, of gender presentation. I'm also thinking of Michael Field, who's the lesbian couple who wrote together under a single name, also very much linked with decadence, this movement. The color yellow is a big part of it. But anyway, so Max Nordau links this to, you know, he basically says that these artists who are effete, and I guess, sorry, the better reference in France is Des Essences and Huysmans' book, A Rebours, or Against Nature. But, you know, this idea that to spend one's days languishing and trying to appreciate only the finer things in life is a marker of like the decline of civilization. And just in general, the fin de siècle is characterized by this idea coming from Darwin, rethought by these figures at the end of the century, of basically just decline. And a lot of people point back to other empires, you know, the Roman Empire and its late stages, and how it's taken up with these themes. It gets pervaded by these, you know, like effeminacy, lethargy, artifice, apathy, ennui. And Nordau was worried that this was, the artists were sort of causing these things to occur in like innocent French society. And, you know, this idea that it's a disease, that it's a disease that creates further deviancy, that it creates and encourages lesbianism, like homosexuality, which also is, are terms that really emerge and, you know, get, like sociology is a discipline emerging at this point as well. So everything's sort of tied together. But at the same time, you have this new visibility of different forms of gender presentation and sexuality, women who are expressing themselves in sexually liberated ways, dressing like men, quote unquote, male artists who are dressing more effeminate and like dandy-ish, and how this is linked in France to things like the declining birth rate and, you know, a panic about the virility and strength. Also after the humiliation of France, you mentioned the Franco-Prussian War in 1870, this fear that France was becoming like unmasculine, effeminate.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And I really appreciate you bringing up Nordau. That was perfect. He also had specific things to say about both consumerism and addiction. Like he likened oniomania, which is like the obsession with buying things. So this buying craze, that he was like, that is a form of hysteria, which is a form of addiction, which is inherently feminine, and that is going to degenerate our society. Like these women who are so obsessed with buying these new things and consuming and like being taken in by these advertisements, much like the ones that we just showed of the cocaine wine, right? So sometimes buying and being taken in by advertisements would also lead to addiction, which was both caused and was caused by hysteria and degeneration.
Right.
You know what I mean?
I don't know if I said it explicitly earlier or not, but like, it's also this orientalizing thing, right? That it's also collapsed onto this idea. And I don't think it's a coincidence that morphine is linked to opium and associated with opium, which is associated with the Orient.
Yes, which is not civilized, right? And so there's actually, I wrote down this quotation from Nordau that relates to this, because he uses the phrase civilized peoples, right, in relation to like what addiction can do to them. And he speaks in the language of race and racism. In a way. So he writes, or he wrote, a race which is regularly addicted, wink, wink, nudge, nudge, mm-hmm. people in the East, right? A race which is regularly addicted, even without excess, to narcotics and stimulants in any form, such as fermented alcoholic drinks, tobacco, opium, hashish, also orientalized, yeah. begets degenerate descendants who, if they remain exposed to the same influences, rapidly descend to the lowest degrees of degeneracy, to idiocy, to dwarfishness, etc., that the poisoning of civilized peoples continues and increases at a very rapid rate is widely attested by statistics.
It's a short jump to eugenics, right? Which is also in the background of a lot
the
of
the shortest jump.
The shortest of jumps. Jump. Maybe not even a jump.
Maybe just
it's,
a hop.
It's already touching.
It's already touching.
But because, you know, like with this idea that like we must protect civilization from degeneration and decay, how are we going to protect civilization from degeneration and decay, especially when there's a falling birth rate and all this other, you know, I mean,
yep.
the jump in that, in what you were just reading out from like tobacco to dwarfism. I mean, the leap with yep. which we suddenly are like, you know, critiquing and criticizing people with disabilities as like associated with disease and undesirability. I mean,
yeah. And I mean, it's all tied up in the history of reproduction as well. Like that yes. is, as you're saying, short leap to eugenics. But so what I just said about Nordau equating like feminine hysteria to buying crazes to morphinomania to addiction, all of that really brings us into, we've already touched upon it quite a bit, and you can definitely read it in the Grasset print, but it's the sensationalization and the fear around female addiction in particular.
Yeah.
So as I said, morphine injection was specifically associated with women. And again, it was like, okay, men smoked, women injected morphine. And it was either like pretty young women who were bored or older women who had been broken by life, right? And so, you know, that's that middle class thing that you were talking about, like those two tropes. And the other reason was that, you know, women are weaker, so they're more likely to be in pain, so they're more likely to be prescribed drugs. Interesting thing is that like, so there's this idea that it was these women who are being prescribed these drugs who had this iatrogenic addiction who were like the morphine addicts, like that's the majority. In yeah. reality, it's male doctors who were addicted to morphine. Like that was most typical morphine addict.
God, right? That's so interesting, because it's like yeah. you're never going to see a print of a male doctor.
Oh my gosh,
morphine.
So glad you said that, because Hannah Halliwell specifically argues that artists ignore that fact willfully.
Yeah. Yeah. It doesn't fit this like fantasy act. Like, we talked about vampires. We talked about like women on broomsticks. I mean, we've danced around the new woman as well, but you know, this just an increase in women's independence and rejection of sort of bourgeois values at this point. It's interesting to me, like the similarities and the differences from discourse around the current opiate epidemic, more specifically, like, you know, America is a declining civilization, or like, you know, it's a civilization
empire.
At the end, yeah, sorry, empire in its death throes, which fits perfectly with these, you know, endings associated with decadence and degeneration. But what has shifted is the class politics, and I think that's what also sees the shift in how we're reading people with addiction, right? So like,
yeah,
you know, we are now like 99.9% of Americans are working class, and sort of the canonical definition of the working class. And so that it's not this like bourgeois.
I think that's really interesting. You're right. The class stereotypes have shifted. And I think the gender stereotypes are different as well. But I guess I guess what I kind of want to end with is reiterating again how kind of different Grasset's representation of the morphinomaniac is. Like, you've talked a lot about like the language of opium and its products in this period. And so I wanted to show you a couple other examples from around this time of depictions of women addicted to morphine, right? Do you want to start with Picasso? Ugh.
I love, do you want to start with Picasso? Ugh.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't really want to talk about Picasso, but here we are.
Oh, I don't really know what to make of this one.
It's weird, isn't it? We don't have to spend that much time on it, but I just think it's interesting for another representation or a couple other representations of female addicts in this period.
Wait, and you know, so what we're looking at, you know, it's got this sort of like rapid brushwork. It's a very broken surface. It's very different from the print. It does have some, I would say, orientalizing elements, like her dark hair that crowds really down over her forehead and her thick dark eyebrows and also this turban that she's wearing. Mm-hmm. But you know what it makes me think of, especially the sort of brushwork? It's not stippling, but it's like a little square, you know, he's pushed a square brush into the canvas to create the facture of the picture around her eyes. Is it Nordau? I read this in my research, who basically was like, impressionism is the result of the disease of the eye, with so the eyeball is like, in which the eyeball is like trembling.
Yeah, so it can't see color correctly or like shapes.
And so it's like everything's like shaken up.
Yeah.
But it does sort of, I think in that motion, it gives something that sort of whooshy haziness of it makes it seem more like a drug. It gives the experience of being on drugs more than the print does.
Right. And you've got this kind of like unfocused gaze, like this smirk that she's got. It's a less obvious title, obviously, than Grasset's print. But it's likely that this used to be called the morphine addict. So it's like a woman who was in a cafe high who was waiting.
Now it's called
for
waiting. I mean, it's interesting. Yes. I can't tell. Is she in a cafe? She could be in a bedroom. It's very...
She was.
But it's interesting that it's not apparent in the painting.
Oh, yeah. But according to Picasso, it was a woman who he often saw sitting in a cafe.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this is like a really colorful, as you say, like it almost gives the experience of being disoriented. And then you've got the other Picasso pastel, which you brought to my attention.
Yeah. It's just, it's kind of obvious. It's like
death.
Yeah.
That's fine.
But it is a bit more like working class. It's more sickety, you know.
Yes. Yeah.
It's a man with two women dangling, draped over him. One of them sort of seems like a sex worker because her breasts are out of her shirt. Mm-hmm. Whereas the other one, perhaps not, but why would they all be together? And the man is anonymized. His sort of face is black and in shadow. Maybe he's deaf. You know, it's sort of, he has this like cape.
I think so.
Yeah. And they're the only points of color. But also, it's got this sort of like hazy, on drugs feel to it.
And then the last one I wanted to talk about was also in my undergrad paper, is by Besnard, Morphine Addicts, which is a dry point print rather than a color lithograph. So it's all black and white.
I love this one.
Me too. Which is, it's just got such a different sense to it. But tell me, what do you think about this piece and how does it contrast with the one that we've been talking about this whole episode?
Do you know why I love this one? Because it's the one that's the most medium specific.
Yes.
So it's a dry point etching of this woman who's turned to face us. She looks very thin. Is it etiolated? Mm-hmm. Is that the word? Like, she has this incredibly bony hand, a wrist that disappears into shading. She's looking straight at us and she looks, it could be a seductive gaze, but it could also be sort of like dissociative, lethargic, like mind altered. And next to her is a woman. Oh, I love. Okay. Next to her is a woman who's leaning forward onto a table and gazing at her, which is also giving sort of like sapphic, lesbian, deviant, in big scare quotes, sexual desire vibes, who's staring at her and who's dissolving. Her hair's like dissolving into these fumes of maybe smoke or, you know, the dry point etching. And then in front of them is like a vase or something, also sort of covered in smoke. And then the figure who's looking at us is pinching between her fingers something. And from it extends this flurry of carefully etched lines. And what's really sick about it is, of all of the media, dry point feels the most appropriate for depicting an addiction based on needles. It makes it feel so physical and tangible. And even though this isn't a picture in which someone is actually piercing themselves with a needle, the medium of dry point and the engraving, you know, the stylus, which has to carve into the surface of the smooth plate, which has to make it rough, make it textured, is so like sensorially rendered here. So like palpable.
Absolutely. I'm so glad. Oh, this is why we do this together. I am so glad that you went exactly where I wanted you to go with this. Yeah. And I think there's something so tactile about a dry point etching as it relates to morphine addiction. And that thing that she's holding, I'm going to betray my ignorance here. So 21-year-old me wrote that it was a morphine quill, but I looked that up and I'm like, I don't know what that is. And I don't think that it's a real thing. But others have written about this print and said that it's a peacock feather that's
oh
been
my
like
God.
Pulled apart. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Which links it directly back to decadence, because peacock yes. feathers are such a symbol of the decadence and of the decadent movement. You know, the peacock being this bird that's all display and no substance, you know, that's yep. like all about decoration and beauty and the pursuit of these aesthetic ideals that are causing this like moral bankruptcy and effeminization of men. Oh, it just links it all together. Like it ties it all together. Even though this print has no color, it gives us that yellow of the yellow print in its own way.
It's almost like I, you know, wanted to end on this.
It's almost like you deliberately chose this.
No, I just think it's really important to talk about this print in comparison with the Grasse to understand the techniques, the different compositional ways that you can go about commenting on female addiction, morphine addiction, and the state of society in fin de siècle Paris in completely different ways.
And the different routes it leads us down, right? The first one yes. is more advertising. It's the new color lithography, it's graphic, it's prints, it's Art Nouveau, it's avant-garde. The other one, it's dark, it's encroaching, it's disease. It's giving, we didn't get to Arthur Symons, who wrote in Britain at least about the decadent movement and sort of this late stage of aestheticism, but he called decadence a beautiful disease.
Yeah.
You know, and it's got that merging of art, the realm of the aesthetic, you know, through its insistence on itself as a medium and by drawing attention to that piercing and penetrating of the needle to this darker disease element.
And female beauty as well. Yeah. So I think that's it actually.
Nice.
That was great. I think that's a really good episode.
And now I'm going to eat directly into the mic. It's dried mango. That's an Easter egg for you while you're editing this episode.